Content warning. Discussions of violence, war, torture and death that some people may find disturbing.
Welcome to the Newcastle Witches podcast. Thank you for listening. This is episode 3, Civil Newcastle, part 2.
So, bad things are happening in Newcastle. They've had the plague. People are being punished and people are talking about how corrupt the government is. We've got Ralph Gardner, for instance. What else is happening after the plague? What else is kind of going on in Newcastle?
So the big one, of course, in the run-up to the witch trials, the thing that looms the largest probably is going to be the Civil War. And we talk about the English Civil War as if it's kind of one thing. Actually, historians don't normally talk about the English Civil War as a thing anymore. They normally talk about the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, which is a much cooler name, actually, as well, I think.
It sounds like something from Game of Thrones.
It's got a very dramatic kind of feel to it.
The War of the Three Kingdoms.
The War of the Three Kingdoms. It's a much better title than English Civil War.
but it does more
accurately describe what's going on, which is that these are a series of civil wars between the various nations that made up what they would describe as something like the Commonwealth at the time. So by that, they mean really the Kingdom of England, the Kingdom of Scotland. So Wales would be included under the English crown at the time. The Kings of England ruled Wales. And they also claimed to be the rulers of Ireland. That was heavily contested by the Irish at the time. So yeah, Ireland and Scotland are heavily involved in this series of civil wars as well. And they quickly get very, very complicated. Everyone has their own agendas, everyone has their own reasons for going to war. And there are actually several different wars that are part of these. So the first one that affects Newcastle really is in 1640. It's actually before the main civil war kicks off and is known as the Bishop's War. So King Charles, he's the King of England and the King of Scotland. But they are both separate countries with their, they have separate parliaments and separate governments. And separate religions. So the official religion of England is the Church of England, which Charles is the head of because he's the king and the king is the head of the Church of England.
Yep.
And the main religion in Scotland is Presbyterianism or the Church of Scotland, which is not, the king is not the head of that. It's a much more loose organisation of quite strictly Protestant churches. These are, in England, they would probably be termed Puritans or something like that, but they don't have that kind of terminology up in Scotland. And because this quickly gets very confusing for the king as much as anyone else, King Charles tries to kind of impose English styles of religion on the Scots. He wants them to adopt an English prayer book, have bishops, which is very much the way the Church of England does things. And to the Scots, this is next to Catholicism, which is like, you know, the big bad of the period. Yeah. I mean, if you looked at conspiracy theories nowadays, you know, who are the targets of conspiracy theories? Always, it's George Soros plotting everything, all this kind of stuff that you see on the internet. The Pope is the George Soros of the 17th century in Britain. The Protestant communities in Europe very much saw kind of Catholic conspiracies everywhere. There was a lot of religious conflict going on. So, I mean, Europe was in the throes of the 30 Years' War at this time, which is a huge religious war going on in Germany, which lots of Scots were fighting in on the Protestant side. You know, so they had come back very much, radicalized, you might say. You know, they were very, very strictly Protestant, very anti-Catholic. And when the king tries to impose these bishops and prayer books and things on them, they do not like it. They rise up in rebellion against the king and they invade England. The army of Scotland, the national army, marches south and actually invades England. And this is known as the Army of the Solemn League and Covenant.
That is a name.
Which is a superb name. And they're usually, the Scots army at this time are usually called Covenanters. That's normally how these soldiers are known, the Covenanters.
Don't think I can pronounce that.
And their first stop is Newcastle.
They march south and they encounter the king's army at a place called Newburn, which is a well, it's just a suburb of Newcastle now, but it's, there was a ford there, Newburn Ford, where you could cross the River Tyne. And the King's army tries to stop the Scots crossing the river so that they can't get any further south into England. But the King's army is largely local militias armed with, you know, decades-old weapons, completely untrained, whereas the Scots army is largely consisting of mercenaries who've spent the last, you know, decade fighting in brutal religious wars in Scotland. And the battle goes about as well for the English as you would expect it to in those circumstances. They're completely routed, flee the battlefield, and the Scots actually occupy Newcastle.
And there's, I think, a memorial in Newburn, if you go to Newburn.
Yes.
There's a memorial you can stand, like, on the battlefield where it was.
Yes, you can visit the battle site. Yeah. There are still, there's been a lot of archaeology done around there, so they found loads of cannonballs which show where the Scots artillery was hitting the English positions and things before the Scots pikemen and musketeers went over the river and attacked. But they take over Newcastle. I mean, they occupy the town, and it's not a brutal occupation, but they do a lot of damage. I mean, the church, for example, the cathedral, the font in Newcastle's cathedral. There's a story that it was dismantled at that time by a local mason to hide it from the Scots because they were worried that the Scots, being, as I say, very strict Presbyterians, they weren't keen on all of the high church trappings that you would have found in a typical English church in that period. So they're often associated with smashing stained glass windows, breaking fonts and altars and things like that. So doing serious damage to churches.
So do the Scots just march up to Newcastle and come in, or do they break things first?
There's a big wall, isn't there? So.
And then
the town doesn't try to defend itself at this stage. They occupy the town pretty bloodlessly. There's not a large battle or anything in 1640, but they do occupy the town, and the king is made to pay them a massive fee to get them to go away again, basically. So that's how that ends. The king says, look, all right, I won't make you have English prayer books, and here's a big wadge of cash.
Oh, wow.
They would say is, well, we've marched all the way down here, we need to pay our soldiers and so on. But it's a bribe. I mean, they're bribed to leave Newcastle. But it can't have been good for the morale of the town, I wouldn't have thought.
No.
That would have been the first time that Newcastle had ever fallen to a Scottish army or attack. It had defended itself successfully throughout the medieval period. It had been under siege a lot, throughout the 13 and 1400s. Newcastle was regularly besieged by Scottish armies and successfully defended itself. So this must have been a pretty humiliating blow, I think, to the people of the town. It might have exacerbated a lot of the religious tension that you would find as well. Because that tension between high church and low church, or sort of different branches of Protestantism, is repeated throughout England as well. So there are the people called Puritans in England, who would see themselves as very strict Protestants, and they would see that the Church of England is a corrupt organisation that's very close to Catholicism. And most major towns would have some Puritans living in them. They were a significant kind of religious minority, but they were not in charge in Newcastle.
When do they become in charge of Newcastle?
So that is after the Civil War proper. So the Battle of Newburn Ford is a kind of prelude to the main civil war. The King of England had always at that stage, or from the medieval period onwards, had to summon Parliament to raise taxes. They couldn't just raise taxes themselves. And I don't just mean raise taxes as in put them up. I mean get taxes at all.
Oh.
The general way that you raise taxes, there was no income tax in the Middle Ages or the 17th century. If the king was going to war and needed a tax, he would impose like an income tax or a property tax or a poll tax, and they would collect a certain amount of money for every person, 10% of your income or something like that in 1 year. But you didn't regularly pay that. It wasn't like nowadays where you pay 20% of your income to the government whenever you get your paycheck. It was every time the king wanted taxes, he had to go to Parliament and say, I want to make a tax to get some cash to go to war with France.
Right, okay.
And having spent lots of money fighting his own people, the Scots, he is also the King of Scots, when he next goes to Parliament trying to raise a tax, they refuse. There's a big falling out, which is a minor way of putting it, because it kicks off into a civil war, which ends up as one of the most devastating conflicts in British history, really. Lasts for about 10 years and causes massive damage to the country. I mean, tens of thousands of people are killed. You know, some estimates are that something like between 10 and 20% of the population are of England are killed or displaced during this conflict. The local populations are raised into the armies of the various sides. So Newcastle raises a large regiment. 3,000 men are taken from Newcastle by the Duke of Newcastle, and he forms a regiment for the King's Army.
What year was kind of this happening?
So this is 1642. This really kind of kicks off. Newcastle is very much on the royalist side. Mm-hmm. So Newcastle's mayor, John Marley, and most of the local gentry, I suppose, are very much on the king's side. They're part of the royalist strongholds in the north that hold out for the king against Parliament. Parliament's stronghold really is in London. That's where they're strongest. The king is based in Oxford for most of the war, but has a big block of support in the north around York. And in 1644, there's a large battle fought near York at a place called Marston Moor, where the king's armies in the north are defeated decisively by a combination of the Army of Parliament and the Scottish Army, who they've made an alliance with. So this is a kind of joint army of Parliament in Scotland against the king, and the king's army is beaten. Most of the king's supporters from the north of England at this stage, some of them go into exile in France. They actually leave the country, they abandon the king's cause. And there is now no realistic kind of army in the north fighting for the king. And from there, the Scottish army marches north and takes various towns and cities on its way. So York falls very quickly after the battle, it surrenders. And Parliament encourages them to lay siege to Newcastle. London, by this point, is really reliant on coal from Newcastle to heat itself. They're not burning so much wood in London anymore because the population's too large. And most of the coal in the country is coming from Newcastle. So they really want to get Newcastle fast so that they can restart those shipments of coal because they're worried that it's going to be a cold winter in 1644. And the battle's quite late in the year, so it's summer before the battle's fought, so they don't have too long to capture the town. And the Scots march north and they lay siege to Newcastle in 1644. They completely surround the town and begin bombarding it with their artillery, trying to batter the walls down. And, of course, trying to make the people within the town surrender. That's really the focus of any siege. Most attacking armies don't actually want to have to storm a town or anything like that. It's hugely dangerous, especially one with walls as large and well-fortified as Newcastle's. So they would like the people inside to surrender. And they think that's a pretty sure thing because there's no army that's going to come and relieve them. You know, there are no royalist armies in the north. There's nobody's going to come and rescue them. But the town holds out, so the town's mayor refuses to negotiate. This is a guy called John Marley.
So he just flatly denies them entry. Into, he just says no.
Yeah.
He just
He's probably got a few soldiers in the town, and he's got the town's population who are fighting with whatever weapons they can get. Muskets, but also probably older stuff like crossbows. We're told about clubs with nails through them. Being used,
so old-fashioned.
Herculean clubs, so
which aren't very useful if the people are standing on the other side of the wall with cannons.
No, but once they start to come through the walls or trying to come through the gates, they can cause some serious damage. And actually, the Scots have a writer with them. It's one of the reasons that we know so much about the siege. The Scots actually have a guy called William Lithgow travelling with them, who's a Scottish writer. He's a travel writer. He travelled all over Europe and the Middle East and North Africa and places. But he was with the Scottish army at the siege of Newcastle, and he writes an eyewitness account. And he says that the enemy did more damage with Herculean clubs than with hand grenades or shot.
It's typical Geordies again.
Well, yeah, you know, clubbing people who are trying to come over your walls. But it was a nasty conflict, certainly, and the town was in dire straits throughout the siege. I mean, it was surrounded, it was cut off from any supplies.
How long did this last?
So this lasted from, I think it's July through to October. So it's several months, which is an incredible amount of time to hold out with no real support. The Scots were attacking forts further down the river, so they took South Shields. So they were able to block ships from coming up the river, so they couldn't bring supplies in from the sea. They blocked off all of the major roads, occupied the towns around, so Elswick, Benwell, Gateshead, were all occupied by Scottish forces. Sunderland was occupied at that time as well. In fact, they were parliamentarian supporters. Some people think that the famous rivalry between Newcastle and Sunderland actually dates to the Civil War, that Sunderland supported Parliament and Newcastle were royalist, and that this is the origin of the rivalry. I'm not sure that I really buy that. I think if an army of 30,000 heavily armed Scotsmen rocks up in Sunderland, which at the time would be a village of a few hundred people, and says, hello, can we camp here? I mean, you know, there's no realistic way of going, no. You know, it's, you either let them encamp in your town or you die.
But you know what, though? I feel like there's a part that the people are bitter enough to pass that on to their children of, you really need to hate anyone from Sunderland. I mean,
well, yes.
The gossip thing goes back so many years. I would not be surprised if, like, they just really held on to it and were like, it's their fault. It's not, but I could see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's as good an explanation as any, I think. So, but yeah, the town is besieged for a long period of time. People are cut off from any supplies of food. They're starving. And in the end, the Scots are forced to storm the town in October. So October the 19th, they detonate mines that they've dug under the walls. So this is, they get miners from Elswick, Benwell, and some of the towns in the West End to dig under the walls of Newcastle. They pull the foundations of the stone walls out, replace these with kind of wooden props so that the walls stay up long enough for you to get out of your little tunnel. But then they pack them with barrels of gunpowder, and at a given signal on that morning, they detonate them all at the same time. They blow the walls sky high, basically. And then they storm the town. So they actually attack these breaches in the wall with their soldiers and just storm the town, storm through the gaps.
But there's no real soldiers inside. So who are they?
Well, there certainly are people defending the town. So there are a few soldiers, or at least armed citizens of the town to defend them. Again, Lithgow talks about musket balls flying into the faces of Scottish soldiers as thick as hailstones as they come through the breach. You've got to think these are very narrow gaps. You're able to concentrate a lot of fire on those. And they're trying to push through this into the town. And we're told that there is, in one of my favourite quotes, that there's fierce fighting in the big market. Which, you know, maybe broken on a Friday night.
I was like, nothing's changed.
This is not funny, Caitlin.
Which is, it's, yeah.
It's just the fact it's the big market.
It's that mention of the big market, which is the central marketplace of the town. And it was, there was hand-to-hand fighting in the streets of the town until at last one of the soldiers in the town, one of the commanders of the town, lays down his sword. He surrenders the town to the Scots. The mayor is nowhere to be seen by this point. He's actually hiding in the castle, which has been his command post. He's had cannon mounted in the castle. He's had it refortified. And he basically locks himself in the castle as the town falls around him. The Scots take the town, ring the church bells as a sort of sign of victory. But Marley is still holed up in his fortress inside the castle of Newcastle in the keep until about 3 or 4 days later he's forced to surrender. He hasn't actually stocked the castle for a siege, so he has no supplies or food. And he tries at this stage to negotiate with the Scots to say, well, can me and my men march out of this town? And he's flatly told, no, you had your chance to negotiate, mate, and it was 4 months ago. You know, we've just stormed this town.
Yeah.
And Marley is actually locked up in the dungeon of the castle. He's thrown into the prison at the basement of the castle keep, which is at the time the county jail for Northumberland. And Lithgow certainly thinks he's going to be executed. He says to await the headsman. So he imagines that Marley is going to be executed. In the event, Marley is a far too slippery a customer for that. He escapes and gets to France, where he joins the king, the king's son, and other royalist supporters in exile eventually after the Civil War, and comes back when, during the Restoration, he actually reappears and becomes mayor of Newcastle again. So he has a good few years in France after the Civil War.
So what year did they finally surrender?
So 1644. October 1644, and the Scots occupy Newcastle. It's one of their strongholds in the north. And actually, eventually, within 2 years of that, 1646, King Charles comes north and surrenders himself to the Scots. He thinks they'll treat him better than Parliament. And he's imprisoned in Newcastle for about a year or so. Quite a comfortable imprisonment, I think. He's in a place called Anderson House, which is around where Eldon Square is nowadays, a huge mansion house with gardens and things surrounding it. It's very distinctive on early maps of Newcastle, and he's under house arrest in there. And there's all sorts of stories that he went out to Shieldfield to play golf.
I heard this story.
Yeah, is he used to be allowed onto the river. Well, we don't really know, I don't think. I mean, there's no primary source for those things from the time. So we can take them with a pinch of salt. But I think he was under fairly comfortable imprisonment to begin with. He was certainly
allowed odd story that he was just plenty playing of golf.
Leeway. Oh, yeah, just hanging out. That's why one of the high rises is called King Charles Towers, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was also, what else was he supposed to do? Oh, drinking in the Old George. I'm not convinced by that either, but the Old George is certainly the pub in the big market is of an age that King
we
Charles could have
drunk
in there.
We don't want to ruin
their
USB. So. No, like, I mean, we don't want to take anything away from the pub.
Beautiful 17th century pub.
You should go and have a drink.
Whether King Charles ever did really drink there, I don't know, but yeah, the pub is certainly of that era. And he also went to St. Nicholas Church, so the cathedral in Newcastle now. It wasn't the cathedral then, it was just one of the parish churches. We're told one of the Scottish preachers would sort of continuously harangue poor Charles while he was in church. He was made to go to these church services where this Scottish preacher would preach about the wickedness of evil kings and tyrants and things like this from the Bible, and with a clear kind of eye on poor old Charles.
Just forced to go to church where he's just being like told off the entire time.
Basically, yeah. That's roughly how it goes. It gets worse for him though, because
it does get worse for him.
Yeah, the Scots sell him basically to Parliament.
Oh.
So they sell him to the English Parliament effectively.
So he ran away from Parliament hoping to get a better outcome.
Yeah.
To then get sold back to Parliament.
And then get sold back to Parliament. The Scots hand him over to Parliament, and he is put on trial. And I mean, to cut a very long story short, because a huge amount you could say about his trial, but he's put on trial for high treason. This is a huge change in the way the country runs. I mean, the idea of a king being put on trial for treason almost doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make sense.
But he was accused of being the enemy of the Commonwealth, of the people. Mm. And Parliament blamed him for this bloody war that had destroyed so much of the country, and said, you know, by trying to continue this war, by refusing to surrender and come to reasonable terms with Parliament, he is prolonging the war, and he is therefore an enemy of the people of England, Scotland, Ireland, and is therefore a traitor to his own country. And Charles is executed in London in January 1650.
Oh.
So this is kind of around the same time as the witch trials are happening, between 1649 and 1650, is the time when Charles himself is on trial and, you know, takes us past the time of his execution. Again, I don't think you can overestimate just the kind of shockwaves that sends through the community in Newcastle and England and Scotland more widely. I mean, I think Europe-wide, you know, was unprecedented for a people to overthrow their own king and execute him.
Yeah.
And then have no king to replace him with either.
Yeah, so who's going to step in now? And I guess that creates a huge power vacuum, and people are going to be opportunists.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Parliament takes over the rule of the country when the king is executed. And in Newcastle, the old town corporation, who were strongly royalist, in fact, Lithgow calls them malignants, papists, or even atheists. It's like in order of badness, like the three worst things he can think
those
of.
Those dirty atheists.
You could possibly be. He's like, that's even worse than being a Catholic, which is slightly worse than being a malignant, a royalist. But the old town corporation, who are royalist, are removed, or they're dead because they've been killed in the siege, and they're replaced by a sort of Puritan council loyal to Parliament. So the town corporation, by the time of the witch trials, is a different group of people, effectively, much more hardline in religious terms.
And are they at all trying to, I don't know what the term would be, but to kind of cleanse the city of all the badness of all the old traditions and superstitions? Is this something that they care about, or is it purely about trade?
I think most things do come down to money, don't they, when you boil it down. But I do think there's certainly an element of that. I think there's this huge outpouring of, you know, trying to, yeah, as you say, sort of cleanse the town. You know, you've had the plague, God's punishment on a wicked town. Then you've had the Civil War, in which Newcastle stubbornly defended itself but lost. You know, another sign of God's judgment against the people of the town. And then this corporation takes over, and it's tempting to think of them, yeah, trying to kind of purge the wickedness that's caused so much misfortune in the town and trying to kind of make it a more godly place. I do also wonder, because one of the things that we don't know very much about, sadly, is who these women were really in the Newcastle witch trials. We don't have a massive amount of information about them. And I wonder whether it's possible that they are the widows of prominent royalists or supporters, and that there's a political element to the witch trials, where this is trying to get rid of inconvenient people who are perhaps related to some of the people who've died. I mean, some of the names certainly, there's at least one Madison, who are a big family who start out as royalist supporters. Whether she is one of those Madisons or not, we don't know, but she is a Madison in Newcastle, so it's possible. And yeah, whether they're trying to get rid of people who, as I say, have maybe inherited the estates or properties of prominent royalists or something like that, I think is another possibility, that these are people who've spoken out against the town corporation or have been prominent supporters of the other regime. It's politics mixed up with religion, mixed up with superstition. You know, that's quite a melting pot, really, when you put all that together. You've got quite a recipe for something very nasty.
Yeah, but also not too much of a stretch of the imagination, I think. And so we have so many parallels with what's happening in our world today, and seeing how when those things mix and sort of people come into positions of power, how they can manipulate situations, and suddenly people who are just going about their day are put on trial.
Well, that's it. Yeah, I think, yeah, again, I think you can see those parallels today. A lot of the sort of political instability, and also the power of these kind of conspiracies, of these groups. I also think what you see nowadays, and what I think is probably the case back then as well, is that people start out thinking that they can control these things, but that very quickly this kind of thing gets out of anyone's direct control. You know, this is, we often talk about witch crazes or witch hysteria, and it is a kind of paranoia, a kind of hysteria that seems to grip areas at particular times, and people become worried that there are witches everywhere, and all of a sudden accusations start to fly and things get very out of hand. And then once things have got out of hand, you can't row back on these things. You know, once you've gone so far as to lock people up as witches and torture them with pins and things like that, it's you can't really go back then. You know, there are similar witch trials around the same time in England. A little bit earlier, there have been the trials in Essex and East Anglia, led by Matthew Hopkins, who proclaimed himself to be the witch finder general of England. Again, under cover of the Civil War, kind of general breakdown in social norms and law and order, was able to travel from village to village, executing people as witches, and getting paid for the privilege, which is what the witch finder in Newcastle did as well, of course.
I know if you look over the border in Scotland, there's definitely a lot of cases of where women inherited land, or they inherited things. Sometimes they did it themselves, or kind of men in their lives would put them in a position where they could inherit it. The women would then be put on trial for witchcraft, they would die, and then those people would then inherit the land or the house or whatever was left behind. So I don't think it's that far removed, like you were saying, to think that it's possible the women could have been, you know, have inherited something that other people wanted.
Yeah, or as I say, had just annoyed people by being outspoken and being on the wrong side of the political divide at the time. And I think the Newcastle witch trials, and I'm sure some of the people that you've spoken to about witchcraft and things more generally, people like Katie and Joe, would be able to correct me on this. But I think there's a whole 1649, there's a whole spate of witch trials around Berwick, southern Scotland, and parts of Northumberland as well. So there is a general feeling in the region that a group of witch finders, professional witch hunters are kind of taking advantage of going around the country. I know there are trials in Berwick, and of course in Newcastle, one of the witches executed is Jane Martin, who is from Northumberland, from Chatham. So it does seem to kind of sweep through the country in like particular areas. It seems to catch hold of people's imaginations, and people grasp onto this idea of witchcraft to give them a focus for their anger or their...
whatever it is that they're feeling at the time. Anger, sadness.
Yeah, you know, trauma, I think. You know, it's again, it's easy to look back 400 years and be fairly detached about the whole thing. But, you know, the plague, a military occupation followed by an absolutely savage siege of 4 months, followed by another occupation, followed by the entire way that you order society and have done for centuries being completely turned upside down, turned on its head. Lots of religious fervour and things added into that. It's a real time when I think people are undergoing severe trauma. I think that's what we would describe it as.
And they're kind of being told by the government and, like, by, you know, the church, that there are people out there who are the cause of all these bad things, and that the reason, like, there's so much sin is because of these people. You're going to think, well, let's get rid of them. Because yeah. Why wouldn't you? If you know something is, like, it's like a sickness, isn't it? I think they have been described as like a sickness or like something to get rid of. You would try and get rid of it or cure it. So you can see their thinking in
yes.
a way.
Well, yes, I think you can. I think, you know, I don't think it's that, as I say, I don't think people think that differently now than they did then. I think if you put people in very similar situations, they respond in very similar ways. What those ways are is kind of coloured by the wider society that they live in. So, you know, we wouldn't talk about witches so much now. But yeah, I mean, in America, you see it all the time. When natural disasters happen, people, you know, preachers appear on TV saying that it's all the fault of this group or that group, and, you know, kind of blaming it on all sorts of people. God's wrath, you know, it's exactly the same situation. They probably don't talk about witches quite as much, but yeah, I think you really can see why people want that scapegoat. They want those scapegoats for things that are wrong, because it's hard to just say, yes, everything is terrible. And I think that's the case with witches. I mean, witches in the 17th century in England, certainly, I think, and again, Joe and Katie are much more qualified to talk on this. There's less of a sense of conspiracy, I think, in this country. It's more of a... in Europe, certainly, witchcraft was viewed almost as being like a conspiratorial organisation that you were part of, that was trying to overthrow Christian civilization for the devil. And whereas witches in England, I think, tended to be more individual servants of Satan rather than part of a big conspiracy that met every now and again. But it does have that sense that, you know, these are people who are secretly working against their neighbours.
Yeah. And this is not some like history that is probably widely known. Certainly I didn't know so much about the history of Newcastle, so really appreciate you coming and sort of, I guess, giving us a picture of the town, of the people, and what it was like to live there in the city at that time.
I grew up here and didn't learn about, like, Newcastle's role in the Civil War at all. Like, I didn't learn about most of, when I started researching this, I didn't know about any of the wider context, never mind the witch trials. I didn't know what had happened to Newcastle in the 17th century at all.
Yeah, it's. I think it's one of those parts of history that is... I don't know why, but I think in recent years it's kind of fallen out of favour as a bit of history that we concentrate on. I think, you know, even in the 70s there were films being made about Oliver Cromwell and things like that. So it was very much part of people's general impression of their history. But I think it's very much ignored now, which I think is strange, because it is, you know, a huge constitutional upheaval. I mean, the Civil War has a ripple effect that goes way beyond the actual period of the war and ends up with Britain being a constitutional monarchy as it is now. I mean, the settlement essentially that we've got now is a result of the Civil War, I think, on some level. So it's a massively influential period of history with a lot going on. But yeah, as you say, very little known these days, I think, generally.
It's important to remember this history as well, because we do, like you said, and we've kind of demonstrated, history has a tendency to repeat itself just in slightly different ways.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, people don't change that much, you know. They live in different societies and they live under different conditions, but they are still human beings. and they're responding the way human beings always do. It's worth remembering that when we, you know, that's another reason to remember it. These were real people going through all of this stuff. And it's, again, at a distance of 400 years, it can be easy to kind of reduce people to being sort of stereotypes. And it can be hard to remember that, you know, these were real people, the same as us, going about their normal lives. And these events were what were shaping their lives for better and worse.
Newcastle Castle is a fascinating place.
Absolutely.
And you can find graffiti from the Civil War in the castle, because I've seen it. And the whole team there love talking about the history of the city and the castle. So if you are in Newcastle, highly recommend a trip there. And it's cool that your office is actually the Black Gate, which yes. I kind of feel like is really cool. So I just
it's got a kind of Tolkien-esque kind of feel to it, doesn't it? Slightly disappointingly, it's named after Patrick Black, who was King Charles I's tailor, who owned the building in the around the time of the Civil War in the 1640s. But yeah, you can see a lot of the places mentioned, I'm sure, in this podcast. If you come and visit the castle, the county jail for Northumberland is where Jane Martin was held. It was John Marley's kind of command centre during the siege as well. So you can see graffiti on the walls from the Civil War, remains of where the cannon were mounted and things like that.
Highly recommend it as a place to visit.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the podcast, and thank you, David, for coming on and talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
A very interesting and fascinating talk about Newcastle. I hope everyone enjoyed it as much as we did. I'm sure they will. Please find us on social media, come and say hello. We're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook as the Newcastle Witches Podcast. So thank you again, and we'll see everyone in the next episode.